A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. It is great to have you with us today. Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty going to join us in just a matter of moments, talking about what is going on in Baltimore, Maryland, where the mayor is begging criminals to stop shooting one another because they need the hospital space. Andrew, also in the Peninsula District of Virginia, which is the site of the largest outbreak of the coronavirus in the state of Virginia, and a place where the restrictions have been a little bit tighter than they have been in other parts of the state where no cases of the virus have been reported. But you want to talk about tight restrictions. Let's talk about the shelter in place that is in place now for seven counties in the San Francisco Bay Area, including the city of San Jose, where a gun store was actually ordered to shut down on Wednesday after the mayor declared that the gun store was not an essential business. Bullseye Bishop had crowds outside of the store starting over the weekend, continuing on throughout the week. But again, Mayor Sam Liccardo says, even during a state of emergency, your right to keep and bear arms is not essential. The store ordered to close. The store owner said, look, we're trying to get people the guns that they've already purchased. We have this stupid 10-day waiting period in California, but we're trying to give people the guns that they have already bought. The city said, look, you got to go get a waiver from the California Department of Justice, which is not likely to happen. The store owner complied with the order to close. Now, I've not been able to reach the store owner. I don't know if the store owner is considering legal action, but if I were the store owner, I would be considering legal action here. We have seen other gun stores in Pennsylvania declare that they are essential services, and they've said, we're staying open. It doesn't matter if the governor says non-essential businesses have to close. During a time of fear and uncertainty, we are an essential business, particularly when, you've got these new orders coming down in a number of cities around the country that certain nonviolent crimes are simply – not only are they not going to be a priority, they're not going to be addressed other than perhaps if you see the suspect, you take them into custody temporarily, you fingerprint them, you get their information, you fill out your paperwork, and then you let them go and you take that paperwork back to the detectives and the police department. And when all this settles down, then a bench warrant's issued for their arrest. There is legitimate concern about what these policies might mean in terms of public safety. So to deprive Americans of their right to keep and bear arms at this critical point in time, I do believe is an absolute infringement. Look, I'm not an attorney. I'm not a judge. I understand that in states of emergency, many states grant extraordinary powers to local governments. I understand all of those things. But I still think that this is worth fighting. So let's talk about it with Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty. Then we'll get to our hero of the day, our armed citizen story of the day, our recidivist report, our good deed of the day as well. But right now, take a look and a listen to our conversation with Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty. Andrew Langer, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. It's good talking with you.
Always.
So there is so much to talk about here. Let's start with Baltimore. Sure. You are very familiar with that city, having hosted shows on WBAL in Baltimore. We saw yesterday Mayor Jack Young, who has made some pretty asinine statements in the past, it must be noted, regarding violent crime. He has talked about setting up boxing rings for gang members to punch it out instead of shoot it out. Faced with the first five coronavirus diagnoses in Baltimore, Mayor Young said on Wednesday afternoon, pleaded basically with the city's violent criminals to quit shooting each other for a while because they really need the hospital beds for coronavirus patients. So I have to ask you, Andrew, do you think appealing to the altruism of violent criminals in Baltimore is going to reap big results?
Well, listen, and let's not forget that at the same time Mayor Young said this, the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, said essentially that they were going to stop arresting people unless it was for major crimes. Mm-hmm. So, this is such a recipe for a disaster. I mean, I've had my issues with Mayor Young since before he became mayor, when he was president of the city council and did essentially nothing over the course of many years to stem the problems in Baltimore. Then he fundamentally incapable, as you said, making these bizarre statements about dealing with crime. But here is the problem, is that we have a power structure in the city of Baltimore that seems not only unwilling to grasp the crisis that it's in, but as such, what it means is they completely don't understand these other crises when they get up. It is a city that was ill-equipped to handle even the most basic problems before. Now it's worse, with the irony, of course, being, Cam, that Baltimore is home to Johns Hopkins, which was doing some of the most advanced work on the coronavirus. But of course, they're no help because Johns Hopkins doesn't even want to bring on their own police force, which would certainly help stem the problem of violence in the Johns Hopkins neighborhood community.
Yeah, we saw that, going back a year or so. Yeah. And there was talk again about, as you say, Johns Hopkins having their own campus police force. Ultimately, I think Michael Bloomberg got involved and said, you don't want that stuff. And you're right. I think Johns Hopkins has backed away. Of course, Michael Bloomberg is the big donor for the Bloomberg School of Public Health there at Johns Hopkins. And, you know, look, I've talked with Rob O'Donnell, former New York police officer, about this issue this week. I get the concern that if you have, packed jails, crowded prisons, and the virus starts to spread, it's really difficult to socially isolate yourself in a prison, right? It's difficult to distance yourself socially in prison. There are things that Rob suggested that could be done, such as feeding meals to inmates in their cells as opposed to having them congregate in the dining hall, limiting the communal activity. It could be that solitary confinement is seen as a privilege going forward and not as a punishment over the next couple of months. But when you start to get into this idea, when you start telling the public, hey, listen, there are going to be crimes that we're not responding to, or there are going to be crimes where, we may put a person in cuffs for a few minutes. We may take their information down and then we're going to let them go. And when all this kind of calms down, we'll issue a bench warrant for the crime that that we believe they committed. How does that not have an impact? First of all, let's say that every criminal in Baltimore says, I'm going to shelter in place. This is kind of scary. And crime doesn't go up. You're still adding to the fear and the uncertainty of the population there in Baltimore because of the orders that are now going out to law enforcement.
Let's be really clear. The criminals in Baltimore are not sheltering in place.
I know.
When you combine it with the fact, of course, that Baltimore has some of the strict firearms control laws in the country, so people are not able to assert their rights to keep and bear arms. Now you're not going to arrest people, for nonviolent crimes. So essentially, this is an invitation for rampant criminality in a city that is already plagued with rampant criminality. So this is, listen, for me, I'm glad I'm able, frankly, to do my shows remotely, because Lord knows I don't want to drive through West Baltimore right now and sort of deal with the problems there. I've got colleagues who say to me, how can you drive up to the station through that neighborhood? I'm like, well, it's the quickest way in. I don't know if you remember, Cam, but it was two summers ago that I was coming off of doing a show and I got rear-ended in West Baltimore. And I thought it was a bump and rob. Thankfully, it was a legitimate sort of rear-ending situation. But it got dicey there for a minute because folks came out of a bar and were all sort of crowding around and telling the person who hit me to drive away. And I thought there was – so I asked the person who hit me if we could just move a couple of blocks down, and that was fine. But I mean, this is just it. I mean, certainly, other folks – I think the best thing is you will have other people sheltering in place. That will cut down on a certain level of crime in Baltimore. But given that most of the violent crime is criminal on criminal, I don't see any real change happening.
Yeah. Well, and there is that, I suppose, that you're right, because Baltimore already has record high homicide rates, and they've had those for the last 5 years. They are, Baltimore is already a troubled city. So how much more troubled can they get? I guess maybe, I don't know that that's much comfort for residents, but
let's be real. I'm sorry, real quick, Cam. It could get to, New York City 1970s level. It could get that way. And we need that kind of a sea change in leadership that happened after 1977 to step in there and do something about it.
Yeah. Now, you talk about being glad that you're able to work remotely and not have to go into the studio there in Baltimore. that says a lot because of where you're working remotely from. You are in the Peninsula District of Virginia, which is where we have had an outbreak and really the largest outbreak, I think, in the state of Virginia. Already two deaths, both gentlemen in their 70s with underlying health conditions. But this is where the most severe restrictions have been put in place in the state of Virginia, is it not?
So we have a real combination of, because we are a major university community, we've got William & Mary, where I teach here, plus we've got a substantial retiree population, plus we've got a substantial international traveling military population here. We've got a lot of things that are going on, and it creates this perfect storm. So whereas you have the international, you have a lot of those things happening in Northern Virginia. And so Northern Virginia is only slightly behind the peninsula area in terms of the numbers of cases and the numbers of deaths. But because we have a higher percentage of retirees here, so a higher percentage of an elderly population, an at-risk population, that adds to it. And so it's been very interesting to sort of watch. And I think you know this. My wife is a medical care provider. So we're really on the front line sort of seeing this and seeing how things are playing out. It is interesting to watch. And my wife says, it's not about thinking that you're immune, right? What she's been trying to tell patients is, or friends is, assume that you are a carrier in all of these situations. Assume that you're just asymptomatic and you are a carrier. Go about your life as though you don't want to hurt other people, which I think is a very good way of looking at this.
Oh, it absolutely is. And it's, you know, I mean, you, as you know, Andrew, my wife has a compromised immune system. She's dealing with lung cancer. I really want to keep her protected from this, you know, upper respiratory illness that really doesn't have a good treatment and certainly no cure at this point. And so, we've been treating everybody else as if they're infected, but we're also, you know, even myself, you know, look, I we're basically on lockdown. I mean, I couldn't tell you the last time I actually spoke to another human being in person. I think it was earlier this week when I briefly ran to the grocery store, got home and washed my beard and washed my hands and, you know, acted like I had just been in contact with people who had it. And I think that, you know, particularly for those people who are at a higher risk, you really can't be too careful at this point. You know, we're seeing reports now of individuals who we didn't know had underlying health conditions, individuals who are in critical condition in their 20s and in their 30s in hospitals. So, you know, the idea that this is only something that old people have to worry about is simply not true. Even if you are healthy as a horse right now, you don't know what undiagnosed conditions you might actually have that could put you at a higher risk. And so the idea of assuming that you're infected, I think that's a great way to look at it. And I hope that people take your wife's advice there. I do want to ask you as well, because, you know, you are the head of the Institute for Liberty.
Yes.
And obviously, Andrew, in a state of emergency, these are trying times.
Sure.
For individual liberties, right? We are a lot of us are becoming suddenly aware of the vast emergency powers that states possess under the 9th and 10th Amendments of our Bill of Rights. And we're seeing now things. I don't know if you saw the story out of San Jose, California, but they actually shut down a gun store claiming that this was a non-essential business. Now, I would argue that the right to keep and bear arms is absolutely essential during a state of emergency. And if I were the gun store owner, I would have fought. I might have closed down that day, but my first call would have been to an attorney.
Absolutely.
And it would have been, you know, all right, what are we going to do here? Because so you say you agree. Are you concerned we're going to see more of this? And what is your advice?
So here's the interesting thing, right? I mean, you have two things that are going on at once. So you're having a certain degree of limitation on personal freedoms. Obviously, you're having the impact on businesses that is happening. On the other hand, there is also a movement on the part of certain aspects of government to relieve some of the regulatory restrictions and red tape in terms of delivering these critical areas. And so to me, this is the argument that I would have used and I would still use in the case of this gun store owner, that much in the same way that we are relaxing restrictions on medical care providers, and frankly, we're changing the way that we engage in our policing services and our defense services, that this gun store owner is offering up an essential element of safety. Now, of course, this is California, so you would have to litigate that in the courts. But I think, you know, there's enough going on where regulatory restrictions are being relaxed on the one side, while at the same time other things are being tamped down on, and you have to make that case. Listen, I don't know if you've ever had Horace Cooper on. He used to teach at George Mason Law School. Horace Cooper used to say to me, because, you know, I'm a very libertarian guy, and he would say to me that the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And that's, I had the same conversation with Dan Mitchell over the weekend. Dan Mitchell used to be at the Cato Institute about that issue and about some of the necessary things the government needs to do. You know, these are trying times. We have to be able to make those cases that, you know, in those areas. I'm sorry, as I'm sort of talking over myself, Cam. But here's what I know. Here's what's going to happen. What's going to happen is we're going to do an after action once this crisis is over. And we're going to look at the public policies that we enacted. And we're going to look at the things that we did to make things more free and how they work to solve this crisis. And we're going to use those to inform policy moving forward, which is what we should do. We're also going to look at those areas where we did policy things that actually hindered our ability to solve this crisis. And that's where I think the gun store owner has to come into play. I mean, I would be, you know, I think we need to shout this story to the high heavens and say, listen, much in the same way that there is a limitation, this is certainly true in Baltimore, bringing all home, much in the same way that we have a limited number of doctors, nurses, and physicians' assistants, and those resources are being constrained. Rob O'Donnell, I know, agrees with this. We have a limited number of police officers and peace officers on the force. So we need to find ways to make sure that people are able to defend themselves. And I think that's going to be one of the important lessons of all of this.
Absolutely. Andrew Langer, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. I really appreciate it. Where can folks find out more information about the Institute for Liberty or anything else you'd like to plug?
Check us out at ichooseliberty.org. That's how you find us. We're working on a lot of surprise medical billing and property rights issues now. But go and, you know, follow me on Twitter at Andrew_Langer. You can find out what I'm doing on WBAL and the other stuff that I'm involved in.
Fantastic. Andrew, thanks again, man. Be safe, be well, and we'll talk to you soon.
You too.
All right. On to our armed citizen story, our recidivist report, our good deed of the day. We'll start with our recidivist report. El Paso, Texas, where a career criminal who's been deported before was found scaling a fence in El Paso, caught by officers. This from KXAN in El Paso, Texas. They report that the individual, 49-year-old Paulo Saban Montero, he is a Cuban national who KXN says has been charged previously. He was previously deported from Florida. He's also been charged previously with burglary, robbery with a firearm, cocaine possession, smuggling cocaine, larceny, and trespassing. He had was first arrested for being in the United States illegally back in 2002 in Miami. He was deported in 2017. Seems like a long time after he was arrested, but he was deported in 2017. Caught again scaling a wall in El Paso, according to KXAN. Saban Montero will remain in custody pending an immigration hearing now. Our good deed, excuse me, no, we're not ready for the good deed yet. No. We still have our armed citizen story from Hamilton, Ohio, where the Dayton Daily News reports that two people were shot after apparently breaking into a home in Hamilton, Ohio. It was just after 11 p.m. A resident on the 500 block of Buckeye Street says two suspects forced their way into his home, tried to rob him. The two suspects were both shot, both suffering non-life-threatening injuries, according to Sergeant Richard Burkhart. One man transported to an area hospital. The other showed up later at a hospital and said, "This guy shot me when we tried to rob him." Right now, no charges have been filed. Detectives continue to investigate. At this point, looks like a clear-cut case of self-defense. We'll give you any more details as they become available. And finally, our good deed of the day. You know, yesterday we talked about all of those men and women around the country who are front-facing workers, whether it's, you know, first responders, EMTs, doctors, nurses, folks in grocery stores, hardware stores, gun stores, the truck drivers, all of those folks who right now are working to keep the backbone of this country strong. I want to offer up an opportunity for you to perhaps do some good deeds right now. I saw this from Orange County, California. This is a story talking about all of the volunteer opportunities there locally, but many of these are going to be opportunities where you live as well. If you are young, healthy, have no underlying conditions, you can socially distance, you can get out there and you know, continue to be a part of society. There are some things that are needed. You've got a lot of food banks that are in short supply of volunteers right now. Blood donations. There is a shortage of folks who are coming in to donate blood at the moment. So if you are healthy and able to do so, that's another way to really make a difference. These are going to be challenging times. And, you know, as we move forward over the next few weeks and we see the infection rate rise because we're now catching more cases. We also are starting to see more treatments, I think, that are starting to come online or at least see some results in some clinical trials. Those can hopefully be rushed to places where the outbreaks are particularly severe. We are in a short-term situation right now. As those cases rise and then peak and then start to fall, more of us have recovered. We see more individuals with that natural immunity. It's going to be critically important for those individuals as well to get back out there and to, again, pick up some of the slack that we are likely going to see, particularly in these volunteer situations. So if you are healthy, again, if you are able to socially distance yourself while you're out and about, if you have family who have underlying health conditions, I get it. Like I said, I'm basically on lockdown. I don't want to be roaming around Farmville every day where we have had one case reported, only one, and that was last week. But it's still not a good idea for me to be roaming around Farmville each and every day, shaking hands and patting people on the back and going to stop off at whatever store I want and then coming home and sharing that that exposure with my wife. So I'm trying to limit myself as much as possible. As Andrew said, when I am out, I'm just sort of thinking that, okay, I've got it and I want to separate myself. I've had friends roll their eyes at me because I'm not staying 6 feet away. It's more like 10 feet away, even when we're outside. Those are easy things, right? Those are the simple things that we can do. But we are going to be faced with some difficult times here. And so those who can take part in society to a larger degree, your efforts, your muscles, your strength and your support is going to be needed by a lot of other Americans out there. So that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Thank you again for being a part of the program. Tomorrow, I'm not sure who we're going to talk to, but I know we're going to talk to you because we are going to get to a lot of emails that have been coming in this week. If you have a question, you've got a comment, you want to just let me know what's going on, where you live, let me know. cam.edwards@bearingarms.com. You can also tweet me at Cam Edwards on Twitter. Until we talk again, be safe, be well, and we'll see you here soon with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company.